Hello, amazing folks. Welcome to another interesting episode of the podcast show, Trivia Talks. In today's episode, we have with us an amazing and a brave personality, Mr. Varun Bajaj. Varun is dropped out of IIM Bangalore. He is currently a strategic analyst. Varun is also a gold medalist in marketing at St. Xavier's College, Kolkata. Back then in college, Varun co-founded Let's Talk Project and has a background of CFA and actuarial science. In today's episode, Varun will be discussing about his journey from dropping out from one of the leading B schools in the country to starting his journey as an analyst. He will be also discussing about few articles which he wrote on various different topics. So without any further ado, let's start this awesome discussion with Varun Bajaj. Let's go. Well, hello, Varun. Welcome to Trivia Talks. It's an honor having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tarun. Thank you so much. Glad to be a part of this.
Yeah. So before we start, I would like to know about more about you, and the listeners also would like to know more about you. So, yeah.
So I'm currently working as a strategic analyst I've completed my CFA. I'm more than halfway through my actuarial science. I dropped out of IIM Bangalore, so that was also at one point in time a part of my journey. And I've done my graduation in marketing, so it's a lot like a mixed profile that I've come up with, pretty much why, you know, I'm in the role that I'm in. And it's fun, yeah. I'm loving it, enjoying it.
Okay. So as you mentioned, like you drop out from IMB, and like we would like to know about the more about this particularly, because firstly, why MBA and then why dropping out from IIM Bangalore?
So MBA came, you know, more as pretty much the conventional thing that's in mind, like the academic performance in school, college. You know, I got the gold medal in college, then the extracurriculars, everything. So you know, it just kind of drills into your mind. And, you know, everyone, friends and family around you, that, yeah, the most logical next step is an MBA. And, well, given the current trend, we all get caught up in that. And I did get caught up in that too. But somehow, you know, the day my percentile came out, so it wasn't a decision I took very randomly. But the day the percentile came out and I kind of knew that, you know, IIMs, ABC, one of them will be done, I started thinking that, you know, whether that's really what I wanted. And there were a mix of factors. I can't say it's one reason. And of course, it's not an external reason, because IIM Bangalore is a place where you have absolutely nothing to complain about. You're getting the best of everything out there. So it was more of an internal thing, some personal reasons, some things related to, you know, family, my equation with the family and everything. And it was just a web of everything. So at the end of the day, it was, you know, what do you call it? A gut call. You know, I just listened to my gut, had a hunch. I'm like, probably this is not what I want. And I just decided to drop out of it. So that kind of made it easier, because I didn't have to think much about it. Because had it been one or two reasons, I could have reasoned myself out of it. I could have found a rational solution to it. But when it's just so many micro things, it's very difficult to reason your way out of it. And I'm like, okay, so if that's what I want, that's what I want. And I haven't looked back ever since. It's been a tough call. Toughest decision I've taken till date in life. But it's been great, yeah. Everything happening after that, it's been pretty random and topsy-turvy, but it's been great. I wouldn't have wanted it any other way.
That's great. So sometimes when we take, you know, such decisions, our surrounding don't understand it, right? Because you're taking a decision which is very big, like dropping out from IIM Bangalore. And like you have to face those societal pressure, you can say. So how you explain yourself to them, like why did you take this particular decision? And how you move ahead after that?
See, I was pretty fortunate in that sense, because my family and friends and, you know, people who are close enough to me, who had been with me in that journey of cracking IIM Bangalore, they were all pretty understanding of it. And none of them really made me feel that, you know, I've given up something extremely big, no matter how big it was. And well, there was one person. He was the one who mentored me for CAT and GDPI. And, you know, he just told me one thing. Or rather asked me one thing, that he's like, do you realize there's no parallel to this? The opportunity cost is high. You give this up, you're going to go rungs lower right away. And then, you know, you'll probably have to work your way up it. And I was pretty sure. I said, yeah, I understand that. And I'm up for it. More than happy to, you know, take up that challenge. So I was pretty fortunate in that sense. But yes, you know, the further away you go from your, you know, immediate circle, you know, people who, acquaintances, people who you, you know, meet once or twice a year, I'm sure, you know, the moment they hear the story, there's a shock on their face and, you know, they want to understand why. And they're trying to drill all the sense into you that, you know, you should have done this, should have done that. So that pressure is there, but I kind of got used to it. I'm like, it's pretty normal. Like, after a point, it kind of made me happy. I'm like, you know, I'm getting another shocked reaction from the other end. So it's kind of good. So, but then that's it. Yeah. You have to just let it move past you. If you let that affect you, then you'll be questioning your decision the whole time. I think that's the worst thing you can do. It doesn't matter whether it's getting into IIM Bangalore or dropping out of it. If you let what anyone else says question your decision in hindsight time and again, then you'll probably never be confident of whatever trajectory you're following right now. So you can't let that happen. And there's no guarantee you won't meet such people. And with all due respect, none of them have a wrong intention. I mean, every single person who's, you know, been shocked at my decision, who's questioned my decision, I understand they don't have any personal, you know, malign intent out there. I mean, come on, they're talking for my benefit. They would be nothing but happier had I got into IIM Bangalore, you know, got out of it with the degree and everything. And I'm sure it's indifferent whether, you know, I'm in or out of it for them. So the entire focus was towards me. So I respect that as well. And that's it. I respect their inputs, but at the same time, you know, I get to decide to what extent that affects me. So I think that's what I would like to share with anyone who faces such a thing or has faced something like this in the past. You know, like, listen to it, but don't let it emotionally or mentally affect you.
Very well explained, actually, because, you know, our society is actually, they go with the numbers, like from age 18 to 24, between age 18 to 24, you have to complete your education. And after that, you have to get the job. After that, you have to get married. And that particular pressure is on and on. So you can take your decisions, but the society will never accept it, whether you're right or wrong. Right. So, absolutely. Yeah, it was very rightly said. And after that, you are right now a strategic analyst. So tell us about it. Like, how's your life as an analyst?
It's great. I mean, you know, like getting into what the strategic analyst is all about. It's, I think one of the best things is every morning, I don't know what I'm going to be dealing with today. Like every other day, I have a new project in hand, and it's not something that's just, you know, a different company and the same thing I did yesterday. It's something pretty new. Someday I'm looking into a marketing angle of things. Someday I'm looking into the numbers. Someday I'm looking into more of a macro thinking. Sometimes I'm getting into more into writing things down, you know, word to word for the, you know, ethos of the company, for understanding, for aligning all the thoughts. So it's quite varied. And that's what really gets me excited every morning, that, you know, I don't know what my boss is going to throw at me today. Is it going to be a curveball? Is it going to be a straight ball? Anything. So that's fun. And well, one of the key things I've learned from this role is that, well, if you're running a business, you know, or even if you're not running a business, you have to look at things holistically. It's not that the different parts of a business work individually. A decision you take in finance, it's going to have implications on marketing. A decision you take there, it's going to have an implication in finance, HR, ops, systems. They're all pretty interlinked, which is pretty much why in the first year of an MBA, a student is exposed to all these different functional areas. So that as an MBA student or as a management student, and a pass out, they really understand how the different parts of a business are interlinked. And that's pretty much what my role has taught me. So I think that's the good side of it. And again, the flip side of it is that if you're dealing with so many, you know, varied fields within the same role, it gets a bit difficult at times. It gets a bit confusing at times. You know, you end up making mistakes where, you know, you're thinking in one line one day, you change your track altogether 2 days later. So that's the challenge, but that's what it is. There are pros and cons to everything. It's a fun profile. I'm really loving it, and I'm quite thankful, because that's pretty much what I would have wanted had I passed out of Bangalore. So things just work out. You know, so there's some people who plan well. There's some people who get lucky. I just fall in the latter.
Okay. So actually, most of our listeners are between the age of 18 to 22. And if someone would like to start their journey as an analyst, so what are the key skills they should work on and they should, you know, focus on?
See, as an analyst, it's a broad field, you know, like I would like to say that I'm fortunate that I got this role, but there's something you get a few years down into your career, you know, why? Because immediately you may not be in a position to really look into all different angles of a business. So you have to start with your niche. Analyst can, again, you know, it can be something very specific, industry specific, domain specific, functional specific, or it can be general. So I think we have to understand the cause and effect out here, you know, like what leads to what. It's not the role of an analyst leading to what you do, but it's more about understanding where your strength lies and finding a suitable analyst or analyst related role in accordance with that. So if you're someone who's a lot into tech, you know, you can become a tech analyst at, you know, any of the consultancies or a tech firm that's, you know, looking for analysts for the internal use, or, you know, even media out there, all these websites and all that, they're the proper analyst roles looking into the industry, giving inputs or feedback to their client base. So I think it's more about first understanding your niche and then really looking for the opportunities and not the other way around.
Amazing. So talking about one of your article which you wrote, which was on Kautilya's Arthashastra. So like, I would like to understand from you, like what was the link which you created between Kautilya's Arthashastra and modern management?
So that's actually a pretty interesting thing, you know, that happened. This book was suggested to me by my brother-in-law. And, you know, he gave me a thought which I carried while starting the book, and that's pretty much the thought I still carry even after, you know, years after I've read the book, that, you know, this was written, I guess, in the before Christ era, so more than two millenniums back, and even today the fundamentals still hold true. So the difference being that time it was for a kingdom and today it's for a democracy or a company, but it's still the logic holds true, and that's what really intrigued me. So, you know, I'll just share a couple of things that I feel stand out in this. One is, of course, you know, there are some very basic apple-to-apple comparisons there. Like, you know, we have any management or commerce student has read about FAILS, you know, principles of management. So there's unity of command, there's scalar chain, which is just another way of saying a proper hierarchy. There's remuneration, there's subordination of, you know, individual interest to the general interest. All these things have been addressed by Chanakya and his thing, you know, having a proper hierarchy of individuals reporting to the king, paying in a manner that, you know, you don't have people snitching for you, or, you know, just moving on to the enemy. So all of that is there. But two of the things I really found interesting was one of the ways he tackled corruption. So tax, you know, the government charges tax. So how did he try to tackle corruption in that sense? That, you know, even the tax officials or people responsible for executing those laws cannot be corrupt and cannot, you know, just let people get away with it. So that time it was more about tax in kind and not in cash. So pretty much like a farmer, he's grown rice, let's say 100 grams, and he has to pay tax. So let's say it's 10%. So he created a very simple input-output process, you know, where you go to one counter and you deposit those 100 grams of rice, and that guy gives you a receipt of 100 grams. Then you go to the exit counter, you present the receipt of 100 grams, and that guy will give you 100 grams again. Just the difference is, the weights at the entry counter are exactly the same, 100 grams for 100 grams. The weights at the exit counter are rigged. So that's pretty much like a 90 grams for 100 grams. So without even anyone, you know, without any subjectivity, without anyone taking a decision, the tax has automatically been, you know, deducted. He set up that entire system. So there's no way that anyone can, you know, let just some guy get away without the tax or anything. It's pretty objective. There's nothing in the hands of the officials. They're just, in the strictest sense, laborers doing what they're asked to do. There's no decision-making involved. And I found that to be strictly brilliant. Something bigger for me was, and what made me truly realize what my brother-in-law had said, that, you know, even today, it's pretty accurate. So if you remember, I guess, a decade, maybe a few years more back, when we were following the VAT system, we were at 12.5%. So that's pretty much like the tax on the second level of transaction, a resale. And if you read this Arthashastra, Chanakya worked at increments of 6.25. So for the first level of taxation, which is on manufacturing, he imposed a 6.25% tax, which adds up to 12.5 on the second level of transaction, which is a trade. And that to me was absolutely brilliant. I don't know, it's a coincidence or what it is, but you know, I choose to believe otherwise, that this a figure that he set more than 2,000 years back, it was something we followed barely 10 years back. And I don't think there's any better example of the timelessness of his concepts. But even a bigger thing for me was this thing he followed called the circle of states. So we've all studied game theory, you know, in economics, where it's just about, I'll take a decision based on what I feel the other person's going to decide. That typical two prisoner dilemma, you know, I'm in one cell, he's in the other cell. If I give his name, will he give my name or not? You know, what happens? And he took that notches higher when it comes to probably a king taking a call. And he made this entire diagram where, you know, you're the king, or, you know, this is your kingdom. You have your enemy in the front, you have your enemy in the back. The kingdoms behind them are your friends, because enemy's enemy is a friend. And then comes the enemy. So basically an enemy's friend. So he created this entire system where, you know, there are different elements to a state. And for any king to take a call, he would have to take into consideration how each of those different layers of states would respond. And that's pretty much game theory, something, you know, we've studied. We study even today, and it's one of the core concepts of economics. So these are just the things that really make me feel that Arthashastra, you know, no matter the intent with which it was written to run a kingdom, the logic behind it, it's so micro and it's so fine that it's applicable even now.
Very true. And you also mentioned about the continuous self-improvement through training and development also. So in which you use the high officials words like Amatya, territories, Janapada, right?
Right. So that's, of course, a part of it. You know, like for the king, he actually planned out the entire day, you know, like a schedule. This much time to be devoted to, let's say, you know, training of the mind, this much for the training of the brain, this much for the debates or discussions with his advisors. So that's a part of it. And I feel that's crucial for any one of us, for any of us rather. And that reminds me of another book that I've read, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. So there's a brilliant Japanese concept Robin Sharma introduces in that called Kaizen, which is called continuous self-improvement. And that's one of the key habits he explains is, you know, needed for success and happiness, be it, you know, the material or the internal, that you have to constantly keep improving yourself. And I feel there's a very simple math to it. You know, if you just pick up the calculator and go for 1.01 to the power 365, you know, that's improving 1% a day. It comes to roughly what, 37.78. So you're 37 times yourself. If you're just improving yourself 1% a day, just try to flip it and do 0.99 to the power 365. It's 0.03. So that bare basic difference a day can make you 37 times of yourself in a span of a year, or it can make you a fraction, just 2-3% of yourself in that same span of time. So I guess that's why it's pretty crucial. The consistency of self-improvement, continuous and consistent.
Yeah.
Even if it's marginal each and every day, I think that it goes a long way, compounding.
Very true. So now coming back to the analyst part, how is 2020 for the analyst? Because, you know, one of the sector which is booming as of now is role of analyst. Everyone is looking for it because they have to create the future plans. They have to focus the past history and they have to create some immediate plans. So how do you think like the roles of analysts have changed in 2020 because of COVID-19?
I think you're right in the sense that whenever there's a big shakeout in the economy, you know, the work of an analyst goes up, because all the concepts that they were holding true, that were true for years, probably no longer holds true and things are going to change. And that's pretty much what's happened this year. And for me too, specifically because where I'm working, we're in the e-commerce industry. And because of this entire pandemic, e-commerce has seen a significant boost, because whether, you know, there are those sets of people who, especially the youngsters, who prefer purchasing online. And then there are the more orthodox thinkers who are still into the offline world. You know, they prefer going by, going down to the physical store, checking out the product and picking it up. But given this entire lockdown phase, irrespective of whether you belong to the former or the latter, you've been forced to buy online. And that's brought about a big behavioral change in e-commerce for the consumers. And so this is pretty much a year where we're all rethinking how things are going to pan out. Of course, this is not a short-term, advertising-driven transition. It's something that's happening out of a necessity. And things that happen out of necessity, they tend to stay longer than just some temporary incentive. So in that sense, yes, the work is it's picked up. You have to look into a lot of things. As I said earlier, the older rules, all those maxims do not hold true anymore. So any such time is pretty much, like a golden opportunity for an analyst to really make a difference. And I feel the question you'd asked earlier that, what if someone wants to get into the role of an analyst? I feel, as the role of an analyst has no, I don't think it has a specific job description as such. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a blessing in disguise, because if there's no specific job description, there's no specific thing the recruiters are looking for that's going to eliminate you if you don't have it. So it's just about the acumen that you have, your understanding of the current times. So for anyone out there who's really looking to get such a role, I think this is the time where, you can do your own analysis individually, independently, without a boss, without an employer asking you to do it. And, you can just put it up somewhere. LinkedIn is a brilliant platform. And there are all these other platforms. Just put it up somewhere. Just if your analysis is good and someone takes notice of it, you might just get a call. I mean, that's how I like to look at things. That's pretty much why I come across anything interesting. I just try to pen it down, and just share it for anyone in the audience who might just come across it, You never know who likes it. I mean, take today, for example. You read that article, it's there on LinkedIn, and you decided to just bring it up. So it happens mm-hmm. that randomly, but you never know when it might just, you might hit it off with someone for that.
Right, very rightly explained. So talking about the retail sector, do you think a post-COVID retail sector is going to survive in the same manner?
Of course not. The entire retail sector it was anyway undergoing a change for years. If you look at it, the reason why Jeff Bezos is the richest man on the planet right now, it's because the entire retail scenario is changing. People are moving online. They're getting it. They're getting the products at lower prices. More than that, they're getting the convenience. I mean, everything is moving online for that, for the convenience. I mean, just before this call, I had some work at home and I had to call an electrician, and I've just stopped giving a call to those local electrician guys. For me, it's just urban clap. I just open the app, just make a booking, and I know that guy's going to come down. It's certain that guy's going to turn up. He's not going to, delay that. Sir, kal aata hun, parso aata hun. I know it's going to happen. So that's what the online thing is all about. And that's pretty much why anyway, the transition was happening. People are migrating to online. But because of this COVID, it's getting even faster. It's probably catalyzed the whole offline to online migration. And so no doubt about the fact that the retail scenario post-COVID, whenever this entire situation is history in our minds, it's still going to change. I mean, more people have moved online. They're more comfortable buying online.
I'm concerned about the small and medium-sized businesses which are in the unorganized sector. If I talk about the textile sector specifically in West Bengal, in Gujarat, or even in Rajasthan also. So they have this, a bit of problem to go online entirely, right? So how do you see that particular sector? Will it going to destroy completely, or they will be surviving, but in a very small scale?
See, the unorganized sector is obviously going to feel the brunt of it. It's just about how they adapt. Because whenever it comes to all these tech giants taking over certain things, for the layman, and that's what the unorganized sector, the shops, if you're talking about the textile, that's what they ultimately are. They're just laymen for them. So it's all about how they adapt to it. This is a discussion I've had with some of my friends time and again. And, we keep saying, if you look at US, it's a pretty segmented way of doing business out there, in the sense that there are all these big MNCs and you're working for those MNCs. It's just one of the two. You're either an MNC yourself or you're working for them. There's really not much in between. The concept of these small family-run businesses that we have in India, it's not that prevalent in US. Even in US, all the small brands, they focus more on their production, and then they simply just sell their products online. They just offload it to one of the sellers or on Amazon, and they just sell it online. They don't get into the retailing of things themselves. So for these smaller businesses out here, it's just about identifying their niche, their core competence. So if they're the product person, you gave the example of textile. So if I'm a textile guy, I know the fabric really well. I know this is what sells, this doesn't sell, this is what's in demand, this is the fad of the day. I just know which products to invest in. And beyond that, when it comes to retailing, I mean, Amazon, well, it's not that selfish. It can't do everything itself. That's pretty much why they have a marketplace. You know, you can become a seller there. There are all these established sellers. You can go through them and sell online. So these are the avenues that one has to really adapt to in addition to conventional retail. So as to, you know, avoid that risk of being wiped out altogether.
And, you know, awareness and education is also very important, because as of now, they are not actually aware like where they have to sell all those things. They are following the same pattern which is being followed earlier. And another sector which is also got disrupted because of COVID-19 is entertainment. And you can talk about PVR, INOX and the theaters which we have. So do you think like they will also going to survive in the same manner, or everyone is shifting towards the OTT platform?
See, I think that's a different ballgame altogether, because PVR, INOX, you know, these cinema halls, it's an experience as well. So, you know, if I just look around, not trying to use any economic sense into it, but just looking at consumer behavior around me, the moment these cinema halls are back on, I'm already seeing people going there to watch movies. So it's not about OTT being able to replace them, because at the end of the day, you need that thing of going out and watching a movie. You know, you're pretty bored watching movies at home all the time. So it's an experience, you know, you got people, pick up some food outside, go for dinner. So that's the consumer mindset. So that's going to be hit, but it's going to be hit in a different way. And then again, what we've seen throughout this lockdown is, though a lot of movies that were slated to release in these theaters succumbed to the situation and they decided to go with OTT, a lot of them didn't. And the best example for me is Christopher Nolan's Tenet. He was pretty adamant that he's not going to release the movie on OTT, and he released it in theaters. And, you know, for him, it was wherever theaters are open, you can go watch it. If it's not, you simply can't. So people are sticking to it. You know, they're sticking to their norms. And at the end of the day, this is a B2B relationship. So for all these producers and the distribution houses, these theaters, these are relationships that have been going on for years. So this pandemic is a year and a half game. I don't think at a B2B level, anyone would want to jeopardize a long-term relationship, because you never know, the game might change again. Consumer behavior is pretty uncertain. It changes every day. Today, I'm a Netflix person. Tomorrow, suddenly, you know, Scam 1992 comes out, I'm a Sony Live person. Day after, it's Game of Thrones, I become a Hotstar person. Then Tom and Jerry movie comes out, I'm a different app person. So there's no loyalty out there. So no one's going to jeopardize a strong, long-running B2B relationship for a fickle consumer mindset.
Right. Well, like according to you, post-COVID, like which are the jobs which will be, you know, in the boom side, and everyone is going to look for it, and those are the skills which will be required post-COVID?
See, again, not just post-COVID. I feel COVID has just catalyzed it, but even otherwise that we're seeing, all the jobs that are looking, that are more tech-oriented, because that's what everyone's looking for. Mm-hmm. Even those that are predominantly in the offline business, they don't need that tech support at the back end. That's pretty much how things are moving in the future. You know, machine learning, artificial intelligence, it's just to speed up decision making. I'll give you a simple example. You know, taking this Amazon story back to the late 90s and the early 2000s. Amazon, you know, it's always wanted to become the everything store. And at that point of time, they were just confined to books, music, and videos. But, you know, they're like, if you want to become the everything store, we have to get into all these other things as well, computers, appliances, etc. And the year they did that, the first year, they suffered huge losses simply because they didn't know what to buy, what to sell. And that's not what they were about. They're more of a tech company. They're not into identifying products. Because if you're dealing with hundreds and thousands of products, it's very difficult to understand what's going to sell, what's not going to sell. So that's when these people started building that entire platform that has become the marketplace it is today, where, you know, you and I, anyone can just open an account and start selling online. So even for these offline guys, you know, anyone who's in the offline business and not strictly a tech company like Google or Facebook, there are processes within the system within their entire organizational decision making that need to be objectivized, that need to overcome that subjectivity, that typical Chanakya example. I mean, you just bring in tech and probably your guy cannot be corrupt anymore. He cannot just go for an under the table deal with a prospective tax fraud and just help him get away with it. So I think that's where the roles are heading. So anyone who's able to bring such a solution, which makes decision making objective and faster for a company, I think these are the roles that are there. That's why you keep seeing, you know, all these softwares like Python, R, they're strictly highly in demand because of what they can do. And of course, in addition to that, things that, are more thought oriented, are more macro oriented. Again, they're also pretty important because of the shakeout the economy and the industries are going through. So that of an analyst.
Yeah, right. And that's very well explained. And moving towards the very last question, which is also very important. Any advice for those who are stuck in the rat race and, you know, are not sure about their life? So any kind of advice which you would like to give them to, you know, come out from that particular rat race and start something of their own?
See, I feel it's more about being committed to the journey you've thought out for yourself. It does not always have to be something unconventional. You know, if I take my own example, it's not that, you know, only if you drop out of some place are you truly being unconventional in your approach. You know, even if you're following that route of going for schooling, then a graduation, then a B school, then maybe a PhD, and then you start working, even that's a pretty solid route to take. But you have to be committed to either. If you're not committed to it, then probably you're just thinking of it as a rat race because you're just following the herd mentality. So it's about being committed to what you're doing, and it's about truly believing in what you're doing. So if the decision is yours, it's not a rat race. But if the decision is someone else's, just because the guy sitting next to you in college decided that I want to go for an MBA, and you're like, yeah, chalo, even I'll take CAT and probably give MBA a shot, then you're in the rat race. So I think that's the whole problem. And apart from that, if you're trying to break out of this convention, you're trying to break out of the monotony, you have to be committed to it. You have to give it that year and a half, maybe 2 years, where people will be out there questioning your decisions, but you have to stick to it. I mean, if you look at an entrepreneur, he's not making profits day one. He's not even probably getting sales day one. He's putting in a lot of money, you know, trying all sorts of things, and slowly, suddenly, they build the business and take it to a level where they're getting sales, they're getting the top line, they're getting the bottom line, they're getting cash out of it, they're paying themselves. It's a matter of years before even the entrepreneur probably starts feeling that, yes, it's all paid off. So if you look at it that way, even if it's a corporate career that you're going for, that same process has to be taken. If you've taken a call to go the unconventional way, you have to be committed to it, and you have to spend that year and a half, maybe a couple of years, probably without the results and, you know, people questioning your decisions. But yeah, personally, based on my own experiences, where I am, where I'm headed, I'm still on a path. You know, I've not reached an end. I'm still growing. I'm still learning. But yeah, that's what I feel, it's worth it. Once you've taken that call, you're committed to it, and you're not looking back and questioning your decision, I think you're good to go. Yeah.
Right. And you also mentioned very good thing in one of the article, which is vision and endurance. So those two things are very important if you are, you know, dedicated towards something.
Yeah, that's absolutely there, because see, at the end of the day, the vision has to be yours. Mm-hmm. If you're not following your own vision, then, you know, you're just probably following someone else's vision and you're feeling it's a rat race. And once you've got a vision for yourself, you've set a benchmark for yourself, you've set a target for yourself, you have to have that endurance, because things aren't going to be that simple. It's not going to be a point A to point B travel. It's not how the crow flies. There's going to be a lot of movements here and there. You have to pivot along the way. You have to make, adjustments to your goals, the short-term goals that you've set up. But yeah, if you keep doing that, if you have that endurance, I think that proverbial pot of gold that's there, you're going to get your hands on it for sure.
Right. So, well, thank you so much, Varun. Thank you so much for joining us. It was amazing talking to you. And we discussed about lots and lots of things, like from MBA to analyst to, you know, Kautilya's Arthashastra, and also like the impact of COVID on various business. So, yeah, thank you so much for joining in.
Thank you so much, Tarun. This was a great experience. Thank you so much for this.
Well, that's all from today's episode. I hope you liked it. In case if you have any suggestion or feedback, you can reach out to me at various social media handles. I'm adding the link in the description. Until next time, stay safe and stay tuned.